Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the very first day of July. Archbishop Rembert Weakland is our guest this hour. As many of you know, who live in Wisconsin, he has just published a book that looks at really the entirety of his life. It's very, very interesting, his profound interest in music. It starts with the evening of May 31st, 2002, which we will ask him about. It's about his family growing up in poverty, the early loss of his father, his being called to the church, his many years in many high positions in the church, and some of the profound work that he has done, including work on the economic pastoral and his very deep work with ecumenicism. And we're going to talk with him about all of that. So there's a lot to cover during the course of this hour. I remember I was thinking about this last night. I haven't seen him for about 20 years. And the last time our formal interview, lightning struck the tower of the radio station that I was working at. And I thought, oh, no, what's this a signal of? I wasn't sure at that point, but we hope that that doesn't happen during the course of this hour. We will be welcoming phone calls for the Archbishop. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@WPR.org. Archbishop Weakland, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathy.
Yeah.
Good morning.
You look fabulous. You're in your 80s now. You really
I'm 82 now.
Yeah.
I always say I have no major illnesses, but lots of infirmities that come with old age. Your skin begins to go on you. Your eyes get cataracts. All the things, your hearing, that come with old age. But I have no major illnesses, and I'm lucky in that.
Good for you. Good. I remember interviewing Frank Seidler. He was a wonderful man. And during every new decade, he would get these medical books on what happens to the body. And when he was in his 80s, I think I interviewed him when he was 82, he said, this is what happens to the body from 80 to 90. And he lived to be 94, I believe.
Yes.
So,
yes, great guy.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being with us. This was a work that really reflected on your whole life. You obviously spent a lot of time on this.
I did. I began it more for my sake. And I was working with a psychiatrist just to go through my whole life and see who and what I was. And so I began to write it. And it was only after I did a bit of it that I got the idea of publishing it and sharing it with others. But that was not an easy decision. To be totally honest about one's own self is never easy. And people my age were not brought up in a generation where you talked about yourself in the same kind of terms that the younger generation just take for granted. For us, it was very unusual. Mm-hmm. And so for me to have to go back over my whole life and look at it from a different angle from what we know now was helpful. On the other hand, I tried very hard to say what I was thinking then, how I was living through it then. So I'd go to the archives or whatever, my own archives. I would look at letters I wrote to my mother, let's say, from a period of time, and I would reread them. And then I would sit back with a legal pad and kind of say to myself, what was I thinking? How was I feeling? What was going through my heart and my mind at that point in my life? That was new to me to try to do that. And I found it very helpful to me personally to kind of pull my whole life together. So, for example, I'd never realized how important music was to me, even though it did not become my career. Still, I couldn't have lived without it through all these years. And I came to the realization that often my emotional expression, which I didn't do so much in terms of my work, often came through in my music. So, for example, I remember taking the Myers-Briggs, that test of what your inner, you know, you probably have
right.
Myers-Briggs. Well, I wasn't surprised when I turned out to be a high introvert, because I am. I was a monk. But I'm also a high F feeling. And I said to the doctor, I said, oh, no, I'm a high T. I'm a thinker. I'm priding myself on my brain. And he said, oh, Bishop, it has nothing to do with your IQ. Watch how you play the piano and how you preach. That shows you're a high F. So all of that kind of thing one had to learn and to accept and be content with looking at all that's happened to you and why. And so I decided then at a certain point to publish it, and I'm glad I did.
I'm glad you did, too. Well, in a way, wasn't it a priest who recognized the musical talent that you had? You were playing piano at a very young age and sort of planned your future for you based on the musical talent. You were obviously a very good student as well, but you were playing for other parishes, and your path got decided at that time.
We were very poor, as you probably read. It was during the Depression, and so we had nothing. But we did have a piano. It was an old upright that weighed a ton, but it kept its pitch. It was pretty good. And I had 10 volumes of music. So when I was about 7, I started to go through these volumes. And then in third grade, one of our teachers, one of the sisters, taught us all about major and minor scales. She taught us all about how to recognize the sharps and the flats and everything. I took it for granted that all kids knew that when they were in third, fourth grade. But it helped me then at the piano, because I was reading this same material in those books and playing and trying to get the right notes and understand it all. But I didn't take any lessons until I was in the seventh grade. Mm-hmm. And it was then the pastor who decided that I should get lessons, and one of the sisters who taught me, a wonderful little wee nun, Sister Leonilla. We called her Sister Vanilla. But she was a great, great woman and taught me how to play correctly, and at the same time then started me on organ, playing the organ. So from then on, music became very much a part of my life. And later, I went to Juilliard, did my master's degree in piano at Juilliard, went over to Columbia University to do a doctorate in music history. But music has always remained very integral to who and what I am, not to play in public, but somehow to get that kind of expression of myself that's necessary.
And sometimes a release. You've been through difficult times here in the past few years. It helps to just... I've done that, just play the piano. I don't play for anybody in the world but myself.
Good for you.
But it helps.
Good for you.
It helps to do that. Let's talk about the Depression for a while. I knew that you had a rough childhood in terms of money when you were young, but I didn't realize how rough it was. A lot of people were defined by the Depression, weren't they?
My generation was, certainly. My generation was defined by the Depression. And it stayed with me. And to understand my interest in the economic pastoral letter of the bishops years later came a lot from that those early experiences, being on welfare and what it meant to be on welfare. There were 6 of us kids and my mother. The youngest kid was 6 months old, who had died my father died 6 months after the youngest was born. The oldest would have been about 8 or 9, and then my mother. And how difficult those years were. Every penny counted. We got a check from the government of about $30 a month, $40 a month. And the money that had to go for clothing, food, everything came out of that. My mother worked as often as she could at nights, especially at banquets and dinners, and she'd bring home food for us. We had no refrigeration, and in those hot summer months, you had to eat it right away. So, and then we got WPA clothing. We'd stand in line at the fireman's hall, they lined up, and then they would measure you and make these corduroy pants. And how I hated those corduroy jackets with the patches on the sleeves that never wore out. And then they got so small for me so fast that I was always wearing everything that was too small. Then I would get my brothers and then my uncles and so on. But I think all of it gave us a sense of the value of everything. You never left anything on your plate. Even when we weren't wearing clothes because we had grown out of them, Mother would wash them very, very well, press them, and we'd put them on the back porch of a family poorer than we were. It just was the way you did things. And I think everyone in our family somehow was touched by those experiences.
Right. And to lose your dad at such a young age, too. I know that you kept in your drawer a couple things that your mother gave you when you were 17 years old to remember your father. And they're still there, aren't they?
Yes, they are. My mother had given my dad a gold safety razor, and that's still in my drawer there because she gave it to me when I was about 15 or so. So I have vague recollections of my father, as you find in the book. And I always said, and I thought about this during the years after I retired and was able to write the book, how I was always looking for a father figure in my life. There's no doubt about that. It was lacking, and my mother did the very best she could, I'm sure, but you still are looking for that person who will be a father figure to you. And I admit I found that in the church. Mm-hmm. It's probably one of the reasons why my pastor was so important to me, and why when I went away to school, the teachers and so on. It's part of my life.
Yeah. Let's talk about the church for a while. Mm-hmm. I must say, I was watching a baseball game. My son was playing a game last night, and we were talking about Catholicism a little bit, and I said, well, I have to describe myself as a somebody used the phrase to Catholic who's been on a sabbatical for a long period of time, which I thought was just a good phrase.
Yeah, right.
But part of, and I have a lot of friends who are in the church and admire the faith that they have, but there's something about, and this will get to some of the issues we've had to deal with, the whole structure of the church, the women not being allowed in the church. If you are homosexual in the church and you've had to deal with this in a big way during your lifetime, not being accepted, growing up so that I couldn't figure out if it was a venial sin or a mortal sin to go to my friend Marion Chalker's church next door because she was Lutheran. You know, it seemed just so strict to me. And not all encompassing. And I know that you've worked very, very long and hard on ecumenical relations, East-West relations, Buddhism, Catholicism, Judaism, etc. But talk about that. I mean, the fact that your feelings, and you talk about sexuality a lot in the book, that it was something that you never were able to explore. People didn't talk about some of the things that are just the way human beings are. And And so the church has turned me off in many ways, not to allow women to be full-fledged human beings in the church. Can you address all of that? And despite all that's going on, how the church really called to you and became your life?
Wow. You'll have to read the book again.
I have read a lot of the book.
I think we all have ambivalent feelings toward the church. And we all have ambivalent feelings toward our parents, even. And these ambivalent feelings are not bad. And we had to come to a certain point in our lives growing up where we had to say, well, I guess my parents are human, and come to that recognition, often with a lot of suffering involved. And so we all go through that same rapport with the church. At a certain point, we see the humanity of the people in the church all too clear. It kind of breaks our heart because it ruins that stereotype that we had of a perfect church. And yet Jesus says he came to call sinners. If there weren't any sinners, there wouldn't be any church. So, and when I wrote the book, I picked Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales as being closer to what I think the church is than Dante's Divine Comedy. I admit Dante's Divine Comedy is greater poetry, there's no doubt, and I keep my original Italian copy on my desk and I read it. But there's something about that book that disturbs me because it doesn't coincide with where the mixture of people are, and it doesn't coincide with the drama that people go through in their lives over their religious beliefs and how they have to work them out and work with it. So it's not an inner pilgrimage as much as it is in Dante is pigeonholing people already having gone through their pilgrimage. I found Chaucer, though, as bawdy as it is when the language and so on, it's a little closer to where each one of us would be in telling our story. And he knows that not everybody's perfect, but here we all are on the same trip together, and we're telling our story to one another. So that's why I use Chaucer. To me, it's not a perfect church. That's why I use the word pilgrim. It's a church in progress, and we're all a part of that. Now, the church, I think, had much difficulty adjusting to the modern world. It felt threatened, first by the Protestant Reformation. It felt threatened by the science and religion. I touch on some of these areas in the book itself. And I think it feels threatened today also. So often I find the church overreacting because of those threats. And even though for me, most of them are passé, mm-hmm. they're historical rather than real today. But to get to your question, I suppose what's happening now more than anything is that people don't feel spiritually fed by the church. They come away feeling its do's and don'ts rather than being spiritually fed. And people are still religious and still spiritual and still on a quest, so that the pilgrimage has not ended. Perhaps it's even greater now than ever before in American culture. And how important it is then that the church begin to fill in that lacuna, which is there in the lives of all of us. I think we have emphasized so much certain aspects of church, like the structure, and not enough the spiritual tradition, the contemplative mystical tradition, the aesthetic tradition, which for me was paramount and is paramount. You'd be amazed, Kathleen, how right now I get so many letters and emails from people saying, why did you stay in the church? And I can only answer that all of these traditions that I mentioned, the aesthetic in particular, how important that is to me, the intellectual tradition, the theological tradition, which is not finished, how important that is to me. And so I quote to myself, St. Peter's, Lord, to whom should we go if not to you? But I look at the best part of that tradition, and I'd like to add, because I haven't had a chance really yet, it's social doctrine. It's doctrine concerning the social ethics, if you will, and that it's a way in which the church tries to reflect on what's going on in the world and what it can say that might be of help to people, and especially the questions of poverty, but more than that. So when I put all that together, I'm excited about the church, and I wish everybody could be. and I'm not going to leave behind what has been so integral to my life. I wish I could purify it.
Do you feel that one of your proudest accomplishments was the economic pastoral, the attention that was paid on economic disparities in this country?
I think the economic pastoral is very important, and probably its process as much as its contents. We tried to do too much in the contents, and people couldn't absorb it. But the process, the idea of taking something like Catholic social teaching, which includes the Bible and its practice through the centuries, Catholic social teaching and the U.S. economy, to take those two and look at them. And then the hearings we had all over the country. I was out 1 week every month, all over the country, and then finally all over the world, listening to people. That listening process and pulling that together, not only did I make a lot of great friends, thinking as we were among the Jewish community in particular, but also the Protestants, and then doing a second draft among the bishops, then a third draft, taking a long time, just the idea of getting people to think about all of this, to me, was most important. And I hope that part never dies.
Mm-hmm. And yet you were surprised. You write in the book about the Catholic business community, which was overwhelmingly negative, that there any criticism of a market economy, as if every criticism was aimed at that community.
I think that wasn't over. I shouldn't overemphasize the majority here, because that wouldn't be right. But there was a feeling among so many businessmen in particular, I say men, that they had, like me, come out of poverty, immigrant families, take advantage of the GI Bills after the Second World War, had gone to Notre Dame, Fordham, Marquette, and then got good jobs, and now are CEOs of big international corporations. And it's almost as if I'm saying to them, you did wrong. Rather than you did, well, as they would say, you did what sister told you to do in mm-hmm. all those classes, what we encourage you to do, but now is the time to take a leadership where the next person in line in the poverty cycle needs the same kind of help that you once got.
Archbishop Rembert Weakland is our guest this hour. His book is A Pilgrim in a Pilgrim Church, Memoirs of a Catholic Archbishop. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we also have an email thing you can use here, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for the Archbishop, starting with John from Milwaukee. Hello, John.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Archbishop Weakland. It's really a privilege to speak with both of you. I'm a young Catholic, a trained musician, much like Archbishop Weakland. I'm also openly gay. And I just started reading your book, Archbishop. I wanted to thank you for your courage, because the gay Catholic experience is very often one of shame and guilt and isolation and silence. For me, when I was growing up, discovering myself, I didn't tell anyone, and I delved into the conservative elements of the church, and I found this teaching called corporal mortification, where I inflict physical pain. I would cut myself with in the shape of a cross to make up for what I thought was my sin of homosexuality. I've come to embrace my sexuality since then and find a life partner, but you know that experience of feeling persecuted by the church has never really left me. So, Archbishop, I wanted to thank you for writing about your journey with sexual orientation, because we really need more voices from within the clergy that challenge the Catholic Church's institutionalized homophobia. And I just wanted to let you know that your witness and your courage has touched my life, and I know you've also touched the lives of many other gay and lesbian Catholics. So I really wanted to thank you for that.
Thanks, John, very much for calling in and for saying what you just said. But please don't use any more corporal mortifications that way, because that's not what it's all about. It can't be. It can't be. I think I had to come to the realization, and it was much harder, by the way, back in the 50s and the 60s than it is even now, because now there is a much higher support system. And back then, nobody even talked about it. Nobody would say they came out of a closet. We didn't know there were closets. And so it was very difficult to deal with, very hard to deal with, and maybe one can't expect from people at my age to be as frank as you have been and open right now. I don't know, and I don't think anybody does, what the origins of homosexuality are. I don't think that's been clarified yet. And I say in my own autobiography that I'm not sure whether it's inherited, could be, or it could be something that happens so early on that there's no control you have over it. And therefore, in either case, it's involuntary, so it's not something you provoked. And so don't have any guilt feelings about it. I want to tie this in to something that Kathleen just said about Catholicism. It's true that Catholicism, on all moral issues, sets the bar pretty high. In fact, for most people, too high. It's like trying to do a high jump when you haven't even gone over the little wee ones yet. And as a result, you feel constantly guilty, constantly imperfect, constantly inadequate, and so on. And that's unfortunate. Europeans, though, don't share with me the same problem. And it always struck me as interesting, because they feel, well, it's okay if we have the bar high, provided they forgive you when you can't jump over it. Well, we need more honesty than that in our lives. And that's why I'm always a little nervous about what the bar really is for most people out there. I find in my life, most Catholics are striving, they're trying hard. But my, it's difficult in today's world. And maybe each one of us has our own bar. We have to keep pushing it, otherwise we'll become lax. But on the other hand, every athlete can't run the mile in the same number of minutes.
Why don't you reflect? You start the book with the evening of May 31st, 2002. Why don't you talk about your public apology? You're very direct in this part of the book in talking about what you had gone through, what the legal ramifications were, that you felt like you were walking around with a scarlet letter. You had to talk to your family about this issue. And the thing that struck me from reading later passages in the book, Archbishop Weakland, is that there was a certain amount of, almost naivete about all of this, you know, that you in a sense knew about some of the darker aspects of the church, but you didn't really know about them. You knew that you were homosexual, but you didn't really know because you weren't in touch with this part of you, which to many of us is hard to understand.
Yeah, I guess I would have to say it's part of the whole problem, and that is that in our formation, so often our brains went ahead of our sexuality, and I tended, I'm sure, to do that. I was brainy, and would instead of talking about the real life problems I had, I would immediately write an essay and take it into my brain rather than my heart. And probably music became a great divergent during that period and even later. But you're right. We didn't, and even in my home, we didn't talk about sexuality. As I could talk to my mother if I wanted to, but you had to bring it up. But Irish Catholics didn't talk about such things. And if they did, it was behind closed doors
right.
in a way that you just didn't openly talk about. So you're right that there is a certain amount of naivete in the sense that I knew about sexuality, but I'm not sure I really understood what it meant to fall in love and how stupid you can become.
Mm-hmm.
You know these things by reading books, but to live them is another kind of experience,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of what I had to learn.
Yeah, you did. You were also, and we need to bring up the subject of abuse because it's certainly so prevalent these days. You were also warned, I found interesting, about a certain priest when you were about to go to high school, Father X, I think he was called, and it turned out to be a Father Y, to be careful of him, that he had been accused of fondling some of the students, which I found interesting that you, and then this incident takes place, which I'd like for you to recount, but nobody talks about this incident as well. It's never discussed.
Right, absolutely. That's the way things would have been handled in those days, and it's unfortunate because it was a learning experience and a teaching experience as well, and it just never came out. And perhaps, in a way, the church was so embarrassed by these things that they didn't know how to do it and hid it as much as they could. And I thanked the pastor in my heart for telling me those things, though. I think he was trying to let me in on something that I wasn't ready to understand. I don't know if you had the same experience I did as a kid. My mother would not let us get in a car of a stranger. This was absolutely forbidden. And I remember once a relative who met me downtown wanted to take me home, that I had never met the relative before. I refused to get in the car. And I ran beside the car the whole way home, but I would not get in that car. But our fear had nothing to do with sexual abuse. My mother put deeply into us this fear of strangers you didn't know, but it wasn't sexual abuse. It was always the Lindbergh baby, you know, that kidnapping. And we would laugh and say, "Mom, nobody's going to kidnap us. We ain't got a penny." You know how it is. So it's a shame in a way that this area, this whole area, was not touched upon. And so it was something you knew about but didn't really know about.
Yeah. And you well know this, that there are people who would like very much to meet with you to talk about abuse that they experienced when they were in the Catholic Church. I know that you have a much deeper understanding of that whole issue now because of the amount of time that you've spent exploring all of this in your book. And you now know maybe what you didn't know earlier, that people were hurt. I've read that you may consider at some point talking to these people. What do you think about that issue? What do you think about the people who have been hurt, Archbishop Weakland?
Well, I worry very much about that, and it gives me many sleepless nights, as you can be sure. And at the end of the book, one of the last things I say is about the fact that we really haven't had any kind of deep healing. And the healing of victims, it really hasn't happened yet. And that's a great concern for me. Healing is something you can't impose, and I'm not the one who knows how to do this, I'm sure. I have listened to a lot of victims, as have the others, but I realize that this is bigger than just each victim and listening to their story. It's a healing that has to take place also with, let's say, the parents of victims. That is one of the most neglected groups. And as I watched this, I could see that so often, especially the father of the family, would say things like, well, why didn't you tell me about this? As if it was a way of saying that somehow you didn't trust me when you were a teenager or whatever. And so parents carry a lot of need for healing as well. I think they have to also realize that kids don't talk about things like that with parents. It's not the parents' fault. But there also is healing needed on all levels. The parents come first. Well, I'd say the victims come first, and I put the parents as a part of that right now in terms of healing. In terms of prevention, it's the kids, there's no doubt. But in terms of healing, I would put it that way. But with all the knowledge we have today and all the experiences we've had and all the psychological works that have been done about perpetrators, we're at stage one when it comes to how do you help and heal people who have this kind of sexual attraction that we really don't know much about. The profile of the pedophile has been worked out pretty well. And I think we've had some movies recently which help one see how a pedophile functions. I think those things are there. But we don't have yet an analysis of how to help. And so our next years are going to be not just the church, but the whole of society trying to say, what do we do with this large number of people who are attracted sexually toward children? The solution that one of the European countries was coming up with to castrate doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't solve the urge or the drive. To put them in special kind of medical hospitals doesn't seem to be the answer either. I don't know the answer, but I wish that we would be able now to begin to look humanly at these human beings and say, what are we going to do to try to help them to make their life full as mm-hmm. well? I don't have the answer to that. I just put it out. There's another kind of healing that I think is absolutely necessary. And I would love to live long enough to see the day when the bishops of the United States, at least, or the world, would begin to talk about their experiences with the issue of sexual abuse so that those experiences could become used by the whole society in a larger and broader way than right now, because I think most bishops are so defensive, they don't want to talk about it. But with all that experience, we're just touching the Catholic Church. We're just touching a little bit of what's out there in our society in terms of sexual abuse and in families, in other organizations. And I know this is serious because, and I hate to say this publicly, but I will, when you're involved in something like church and wear a Roman collar, it's a kind of thing that unconsciously will attract pedophiles. And so I don't think we'll ever be finished with that problem because it will always be there.
You will attract pedophiles because why?
Because they have then access to children.
I see.
And I think any profession that has access to children will have to be constantly examining this issue. Mm-hmm. And we don't have any tests that I think are absolute with regard to catching it early enough. Now, that I'm not an expert on. You'll have to get psychologists. That wouldn't be a bad thing to talk about.
No, it wouldn't be.
And what to do about it. So when I dealt with this, I dealt with it in three or four chapters at the end of the book as bishop, because I think the information part of it, the knowledge part of it, was growing gradually through those chapters. And that growth in knowledge has to continue. And I'm sure that what the bishops did at Dallas at the end of 2002 in terms of a charter and trying to protect children and so on, all of that was good. But there's a lot more to do yet.
Mm-hmm. And what about in your mind and in your heart? Is there a lot more for you to deal with as on this issue? I've read differing things that at some point you thought this was not criminal behavior, that people would be able to grow out of this in some way and they would be whole and human again, and so many people haven't been. Have you, well, I know you have, you've written about it, but have you changed your mind about this issue? Do you feel that there's more that you can do as former archbishop, as just a human being who's dealt with this issue in a huge way? Is there more you can do?
I certainly would hope so. I'm a bit defensive about it, I know that, and I think anybody tends to be. I think I'm a bit defensive about it, and I expect that. And also because right now the Archdiocese has suits against it, you know, and that makes it even more difficult to talk about. And I'm not quite sure how one approaches then any kind of major contribution. What I write in the book is more how I moved on this, and some of those things you cited, yes, I felt that at the beginning, but I don't now, and I think that should be clear in the book. The criminality thing I treat in the first chapter already, saying why that didn't seem to be the first option, if you will, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to be honest and sit down and say to myself, Why so? Why did you not consider this the first option? And I try to answer it honestly. Now, you might not like the answer, but that doesn't mean historically. So I didn't try to answer all those things as if I knew everything back in 1977.
Let's go back to phone calls. Carol from De Pere is next. Hi, Carol.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
This is such an excellent discussion. I hate to change the subject, but I would like to ask the Archbishop if he has ever considered editing and perhaps publishing a compilation of the articles that he wrote for the diocesan newspaper. They were so excellent and such a joy to read that I've often wondered if he thought about going back and reviewing them and possibly coming out with another book.
Thanks very much, Carol. I think there are about 1,000 of these that I did, and I have a copy of every one. And not only have a copy, but my former secretary, Delphine Meyer, put them all on a CD so I can do a search, which is very helpful. So I can see what I wrote on the same topic in different periods of my life. You're not the first one who asked me to do this. And since I have all this material sitting there in front of me, I would hope to get at this within a year. How's that? It's on my list, all right, of things I would like to talk about, because there are many, many items that I did write about that are still very pertinent, like the relationship of the church to society, to politics, and things of this sort. Yes, they're very important. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Mike is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to know, Reverend, did you take hundreds of thousands of dollars and give to a friend? And if you did, was any of that money connected with the church? It seems to me that that's something I read about years ago, and I was concerned about it.
I talk about that in the book. If you have a chance to read it, Mike, I go through that rather carefully with what it was about. There was a settlement agreement between myself and a man by the name of Mark Koo for $450,000. He had asked for $1 million, and we settled at $450,000. So, yes, that is there. And I can tell you that money has been paid back, but that doesn't mean it was a good decision. And so I have to live with that decision. Lawyers thought it was the right thing to do at the time. Settlements were quite common at that time. And it's easy to go back and say, well, if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't, but I'm not so sure. Those are always the hardest thing about life. That was paid back. And it's probably one of those bad judgments that one makes. I do try also to say in the book how a bishop like myself, I became a bishop at the age of 50, and I didn't even have a Social Security number because I had never had to pay income tax. I was a religious order. So I started at that point with an IRA and things, trying to put a little money away, but I would never have had $450,000. That I didn't have any assets that would amount to something like that and still don't. Because my life was taken care of by the church, paying for what I needed with a little bit of money for clothing and things of this sort. That dependency really bothered me. It really bothered me. And perhaps the priests were treated the same way, but perhaps that's one of the reasons why we remained a bit immature, because we were not forced to face all these issues. And I think back about that. If I had been forced to come up with $450,000 on my own at that point, I probably would have acted differently.
And a lot of that money was paid back. It's my understanding you had a lot of good friends. You had a lot of supporters who.
Yes, I did. And I'm very grateful to them. Very grateful. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about that moment, because it's one of those moments in life, and you start the book with that moment, which I think is very interesting, that there you are. I mean, you're exposed. People, you're ashamed of what you've done. It's a horrible thing for the church. You've let a lot of people down because you were a liberal icon in the church internationally, Archbishop.
Right, you know that.
You were very, very highly respected. And all of a sudden, you even write at some point, you just felt like you were wearing a scarlet letter, and the best thing, at least momentarily, would be to wait for you to die so you could be taken up to God. I mean, that was just a real moving sense.
Right. That's the way I felt at that moment. And I thank God for so many people who gave me a sense of my own worth at that point in my life. And probably writing the book was the catharsis.
Hmm.
It engaged me in seeing how I arrived at this point in my life, and that's important. It's important. So I'm thankful for, in many ways, the problem, and I think I grew through it very much so. Certainly I became more compassionate about other people's weaknesses, and that's also important. So thanks, Mike, for the question, because you're right.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. We go to Joan next from Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for doing this, and greetings to Archbishop Weidman.
Thank you.
We pray for him every week in our church.
Thank you.
You're a Unitarian, right?
No.
No?
I go to the Native American Catholic Church.
Oh.
They're humble people.
Okay.
All right. In a point about how the church seems to react to things, it seems that in the formation at the seminary, that homosexuality and pedophilia have been kind of put on the same plane. I don't know. I think some of the best priests I've ever known have probably been homosexual people. I have no idea. And in the Native American way, people like that were encouraged to become holy people because they could look down on all humanity in an equal or a different way than ordinary human beings. That wasn't my main point. My main point was, I've been told as a woman, as a liberal, oh, you'll never live long enough to see this or that reform. How can those of us who are very angry about the long history, and I call myself a Catholic with a small c because I could care less, you know, about the Ayatollah or the Pope. I, I could care less about them. It's people I care for.
Okay. Thanks. I need to hold you there.
Thanks, Joan, very much. I think you touch one of the most important issues of all, and that is, how does a church change? And we're very adept in our own society of trying to make change. But we haven't arrived yet at the kind of solutions to change, and we want a change that's not violent. And we watch this happening in other countries where change almost always brings violence. But in our own country, we have, I could say one of the greatest moments of hope for me as a U.S. citizen was to watch the debates between Hillary and Obama. Here is a woman and a black fighting it out for president of the United States. I just was in amazement at this. I just was in amazement. And for me, it was a great moment of hope. Other moments of hope. And if you're Native American, you'll understand this. When I look now at our Catholic population, but the general population, and the concern for the greenness of this planet, that we handle it, hand it on to the next generation in better shape than it is, and this concern for ecology, that we're all concerned about this now, is to me a great sign of hope. I just say, amen, amen. This is great. When I see the fact that so many people now are concerned about capital punishment. That would never have happened when I was a boy. Even anti-war, that couldn't have happened when I was a boy. So there are all these great signs of hope in addition to all the medical progress. And I say the fact that church is a part of all of these things, that's good. That's good. And that gives me hope. So there are those signs.
Archbishop Bernard Weakland talking about his book, A Pilgrim in a Pilgrim Church. This is the Ideas Network. And we have time for maybe a couple more phone calls. Donna from Milwaukee. Hi, Donna.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I really appreciate this show because of the fact that it's well-balanced. Some of the regular media has put an imbalanced view, and I think I just want to say that I really appreciate Archbishop Weakland for everything that he's done for this archdiocese, and I hope he knows that the majority of Catholics in this archdiocese really appreciate everything he's done. So it's basically, I just wanted to give my support to your program and the way that you're covering everything, and as well as support for Archbishop Weakland.
Thanks very much, Donna. That was good of you.
We go to Ron next from Milwaukee. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I remember the biblical scripture, he who is without sin, throw the first stone. And it seems to me that we have a society that is so willing to throw stones, and yet the revelation of truth, I wish politicians, I wish public servants everywhere could just tell the truth and not be stoned to death. And I think your work, Reverend Weakman, is certainly helping for people to be more honest. The South Carolina governor, I mean, it's just appalling that he goes on and on and on confessing trivia, and people are willing to eat it up. I'm looking forward to a society that really changes and grows and evolves through telling the truth.
Thanks, Ron. I appreciate that very much. I would be on the same wavelength that you are. And it's unfortunate that we make the sex lives of people our entertainment.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. On the other hand, the church has some big issues still to deal with.
Oh, my.
And
yes.
It deals with sex, deals with sexual abuse.
It's amazing, isn't it, how many of the problems that the church has to face today and the difficulties are problems that come with sexuality.
Right.
And it's not the Trinity. It's not the humanity and divinity of Jesus Christ that is separating people in the Christian community. It's matters of sex. But isn't it interesting, and I can kind of leave you with this, isn't it interesting that Jesus Christ did not talk about sex? Almost nothing.
Maybe he should have.
Thank you.
It would have been easier for everybody if he laid down some ground rules. Thank you, Archbishop Wakeland, so much for being with us. I appreciate you coming in. The book is A Pilgrim in a Pilgrim Church, Memoirs of a Catholic Archbishop. It is available, I'm sure, in every bookstore and on Amazon, etc. Thanks for writing it. It's good. It's a good read. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. They were much appreciated. We did have, I don't know, is there an email address that there, for people who want to get a hold of you? Or is there,
sure. Okay. Sure. Let me give you the best one because I go in every day.
Okay.
And that's R-G-E-O-W. And that represents Rembert George Wakeland, R-G-E-O-W, at AOL.com.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much. Right. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11 talking about the big issues of the day. I'm not sure what it is yet, but we'll be with you at 9 tomorrow morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn. News ahead and many more hours of conversation on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.